I feel grateful that I can see a little evolutionary step. And I also feel grateful that I still feel so in love with singing and words that I am bound to this path, because I think it's poetry in motion, you know, and I'm so glad to taste that and have that. But I also realise that the, you know, the sort of ego driven side of it, I can drop that. It isn't so important.
Hello and welcome to episode 33 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura Kidd, a music producer, songwriter and solo artist making music as Penfriend and beaming into your ears from my studio, The Launchpad, in Bristol. You can find me around the internet at Penfriend Rocks. Thanks for joining me today as I continue my mission to encourage creativity in every listener by sharing conversations with some of the artists I admire the most. This independent podcast is made possible by the Correspondence Club, a friendly group of generous patrons of the arts. To each and every member, thank you. Welcome to the show. I've had an utterly bizarre day. I can't tell you anything about it except to say that someone I know is going to send stuff about me to someone really musically big who's soundtracked my life since I was really young to be considered to maybe do a thing. Your good luck spells would be much appreciated, please, everyone. I spent my lunchtime alternating between laughing hysterically and shaking, which was weird, and at the very least, this person might read about me and listen to a song that I made, which alone would be a dream come true. And if they really like what I do, well, who knows? Between changing musical projects last year and dealing with the pandemic, I'd forgotten my banal-sounding yet very powerful mantra: if you do stuff, stuff happens. So today was really lovely for reminding me of that. Last Friday, I launched the pre-order for my new album, Exotic Monsters. So I just want to say a massive thank you to everyone who's jumped on board the Penfriend train and ordered limited edition vinyl, signed CDs, books and everything else. If you're interested in having a browse, you can find everything at penfriend.rocks. Yesterday, I launched the YouTube strand of the Penfriend project, which I've been planning for a few months. And my video about why I'm choosing not to play shows in 2021 has had about a gazillion views in a very short time, which is baffling but much appreciated. Not now, because I want you to stay and listen to this excellent episode. But afterwards, please do go and visit my channel and get involved in the comments. I always love to hear from you. Okay, let's get to today's guest. First known for her work as vocalist with the Duke Spirit, Leela Moss's solo albums My Name Is Safe In Your Mouth 2018 and Who The Power 2020, recorded with producer and partner Toby Butler, mark great leaps forward for one of alt-rock's most magnetic voices. Over 14 years, Moss's work with the Duke Spirit, who are not gone, just on pause, ranged from brawling riff rock to the more exploratory Sky Is Mine in 2017. Other projects have included synth rock recordings with Butler under the name Roman Remains. Elsewhere, Moss has lent her sublime voice to studio and live collaborations with Uncle, Nick Cave, Giorgio Moroder, and Lost Horizons. In this conversation, we discuss learning to give space to other aspects of life as a touring musician, evolving as an artist, letting go of the ego-driven side of being on stage while still being in love with singing and words, the life-changing power of meditation, Leela's experience of silent Vipassana retreats and how to bring the benefits of meditation into everyday life and music making, and Blushing All Day Long, the day Leela got to sing with Nick Cave. Leela is one of my absolute favourite vocalists, so it was very exciting for me to get to meet her and have this conversation. Here we go. Please could you introduce yourself for the listeners of Attention Engineer?
Hi, yeah, my name is Leela Moss. And I'm just a singer, really. Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as just a singer, or are you just being humble and friendly as an opener?
I do actually think of myself as just a singer. Well, I do write words, and that gives me satisfaction. But I don't really play an instrument, and that's really been a big disappointment in my life.
Okay.
But I did start out learning a few things, but just the way, I don't know, me and my mum moved house a couple of times. I was quite small and we didn't have, anyway, for whatever reason, I didn't quite commit and have that sort of keystone moment in my life where I actually learned something very well. I did, you know, learn a couple of things for a year or whatever. Anyway, something within me did not pursue an instrument, and I'm very annoyed with myself. But so for that reason, I just can't really claim. I just feel uncomfortable if I say I'm a musician, because that sounds like I'm very, very capable. And I'm not really. I definitely do sit at a piano, and yeah. I use what little knowledge I have of creating chords to help me make melody. Mm. And it's not totally out of my grasp to sort of write the beginnings of songs, but it's I'm just not prolific. So I'm happy to be a singer and a lyricist, and I'm really grateful to my close friends, collaborators and partner for making the musical part.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, I'm disappointed that I'm not a great guitarist or pianist, but on the other hand, it's really nice to sort of share the process of making songs with someone who you think's really good. It's like, great, you get some props too, mate, you know. So it's all right. But when I was pregnant, I made a commitment to sitting down every day, even if it was 10 minutes, and just practicing piano and learning to like read manuscript again, because I sort of had a little bit when I was young, but so you know, I can do a little bit, but nothing I'd do in front of other people really.
So do you think of your voice as an instrument?
Yes, I suppose I do, yeah.
Yeah. And so is that something you've had training in using?
No, and my mum was really good actually. So my mum's very musical. My mum trained in music. This is why it's so galling and ironic, because I'm not even joking. She was a music teacher and head of music in a senior school when I was really small. Then we moved and she was retrained. She's a primary school teacher. So, you know, we just didn't have a piano in our house. So until I was like 18, then it was too late. But yeah, and she sung in the London Sinfonietta in the early 70s and, you know, has lots of classical training, and there was lots of classical music in the house, and there still is. So that influence is wonderful and great. But she was always really wary of training a voice. You know, if you really felt a passion for opera when you were young and that's what you wanted to do, I'm sure if that had been what I wanted to do, she would have encouraged me to train. But she's also quite free-spirited in that way, and sort of said, you don't need to train a voice. It's an essence. It's you. And she was quite encouraging and said nice things about, you know, singing. And just said, there's no point, you know, just no point straightening out what you can do. Just use your intuition. And, you know, that's been the best thing she's ever told me, really. I mean, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps I'd have a better range if I took some training or something. But at this point, hey, fuck it.
That just makes me feel so much better, because every now and again I think, oh, I've got this instrument that's potentially my primary instrument that I've never had lessons or trained or really practiced that much, and of course when I'm touring I want to make sure that it's healthy and I can sing night after night and all that kind of thing, but I've never been someone who wants to do my scales in any instrument, although I play lots of instruments. I'm just glad that someone who knows what they're talking about basically backs up what my intuition was telling me all these years.
I think in this day and age, in our sort of post-globalized and damaged world, what better thing to do than to ignore constraints created by other people, created by probably men hundreds of years ago? What better thing to do than completely ignore all of that and just work with a kind of essential, you know, volition, just like I sense this is right, I'm going to do that. But, you know, and definitely you're right in saying you want to keep healthy. I mean, when your throat crashes out on you and you've got to sing and it feels really rough, you know, then you have to pay attention. Well, before that, really,
yes.
You have to pay attention to the fact that it's a super tiny muscle, and so you should warm up and you shouldn't abuse it. And so there's techniques, you know, you can learn. I did go to a therapist once, I think. I'd been touring a lot. I really hurt myself and I was worried that I'd done some damage. And so, you know, had it looked at and that was all fine, and then did some practicing and just got like a little bit of a better regime in for actually warming up that tiny muscle.
Yeah.
That's all good.
Yeah.
That the sort of science of that physical entity, you know, your voice box and how to look after it. But in terms of sort of how to phrase or how to breathe and, you know, all those things, I just think you should just explore and learn how to express yourself in the way that you want to. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the voice is more than any other instrument. By far, it's you, isn't it? It's like, it is. I love that you use the word essence, because it is your essence.
Yeah.
Anyone can play I'm pointing at the wall that I don't have a Telecaster on the wall, but anyone could buy a Fender Telecaster and it's going to sound roughly the same depending on the pedals you use, you know, the way you play it and things. But your voice is definitely, it's a fingerprint in some way.
Yeah. And you know what? I've never really thought of this before until we're talking now, but I feel more comfortable and more myself singing. Perhaps that's why I want to do it. I feel more, true or something singing than actually speaking, because I do have this, I am quite uncomfortable with my speaking voice. Maybe, I mean, right now I probably sound like I have a really quite a neutral accent, and I just have this weird way of sort of slightly accommodating the accent that I'm listening to. So my accent fluctuates all the time. It is called a thing.
I do that too.
In linguistics it's called accommodation, and it's like good, you know, it's psychologically based,
right?
Phenomenon. And I think it relates directly to insecurity.
Oh, really?
But I will definitely, you know, if I'm chatting for several minutes with someone with a ripe Somerset accent here, mine will gradually turn and I can't help it. And I'm not being facetious, and I'm, you know, it's just happened. Yeah. I spend a lot more time in East London, and then I'll be just, you know, and I despise myself for doing it, but I don't even realize I'm doing it. And it really bothers me that it's not stable. So if my talking voice isn't stable, that sort of seems to suggest I haven't got one identity, and that pisses me off.
Who am I today?
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
That's a real thing for me, and I have to sort of curb it. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, somebody calls on the telephone with a strong accent from somewhere else, and I feel myself going down. I'm like, but when I'm singing, I don't.
I just always thought that was to do with empathy.
Well, yes, it is.
So I thought that was a good thing.
Yeah, why don't we look at it? Really? I think it is a good thing. I think it's kindly. I think in its in its motivation, there is kindliness. That's why it's called accommodation. Like, I want to accommodate you so that you don't. But ultimately, it's a side of, it's a kind of insecurity. It's like, why can't this other person just cope, you know, with hearing my difference in the, you know. So yeah, let's maybe we should deep dive and study into this, and I'll see what research I can find on it. But when I'm singing, I don't do that. You're singing, you're projecting, you're not listening to somebody else, but I'm not in conversation with someone else, so I'm not subject to sort of fluctuations in accent, and I feel like I'm one thing when I sing. And so maybe that's why I always go back to it, because I feel quite comfortable in myself there.
So interesting.
Yeah.
my dad does that accommodation thing. I remember being quite annoyed by it when I was a little kid. I remember him noticing him do it. And he's got a strong accent of his own. He's Irish. So I was found it kind of strange. So if I think about it now, I'm wondering why everyone else wasn't accommodating to him if he's the one with the stronger accent.
Then we'd be all over the place.
Yeah, I suppose so. But then actually, as I've grown up and I've started doing it, especially being in the West Country, I've just started thinking, okay, it's empathy. There's no point, you know, beating myself up about this. It just happens and whatever. And because I have a very neutral accent, I haven't noticed anyone doing it to me. But I wonder if someone has a strong accent like my dad does, or, you know, someone from the north or wherever, like, do they notice it happening? So I don't know that you would notice, because if you speak that way anyway, maybe you're not judging everyone else's accent. I don't know. I don't know if it would make you feel more comfortable or uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's the irony. It might be making the other person feel really uncomfortable.
Maybe.
It's completely pointless.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, yeah.
Any psychologists out there, please feel free to let me know.
Yeah, please. Get in touch.
Send me a tweet. Explain what's going on. I'm just really interested to talk to you because mainly, actually, not just because I love your music, but because of all of the talk about meditation that you have in like the press releases for the new album and stuff. Because I'm on a bit of a journey with that stuff and have been for the past few years. And I was just about to try and book a Vipassana retreat just before the pandemic started. I was really scared and I didn't know if I would be able to do it or anything, but I'm really interested to know about that stuff from your perspective.
Yeah. Oh, well, I actually love talking about it. So yeah, we're more than welcome. And actually that was the last trip I did. I'm trying to think. I was in London for a couple of days London and Nottingham. And then it was lockdown. And I was like, oh my God, I've been in London. I've been on the train. I've been to Nottingham. So, but the weekend before that, I'd actually had like a 4-day event in Hereford where the Vipassana Centre is that I know of. There is one other in Norfolk. No, it's Suffolk. Oh, I must get that wrong. So there's another centre in Suffolk, but I haven't been there. But I was just same. It was this time last year. It was terrible weather and it was February and there was so much on the news about and the whole journey up there and back. I had the radio on and was just listening to various people discuss whether or not this could possibly be a global pandemic. And it looks very unlikely at this stage. And of course, it's a grave concern, but we really don't feel that the indications are. And I remember I just had Radio 4 News on the whole way from Somerset to Hereford, did this slightly shorter course and then came back and it was still the same news. I was just like, God, this is mental.
Yeah. So you've done a few, haven't you? Done a few of the retreats?
Yeah, twice. And I really recommend it. The first time I was so up for it that it didn't even occur to me that long periods of silence and the boredom and necessarily accompanies all of this process. I didn't even consider how that might be tricky because I had been touring absolutely bloody loads that year, and I think I'd just been in Australia as well. I don't know. I was so tired, and I had obviously been singing a lot, and I couldn't think of anything better than to, But really, really, I genuinely felt like the energy center off my mouth really needed to just close down. So my initial experience was it was totally wonderful and I just really needed the rest anyway. Mm. And those two, the quality of needing rest and then exploring this practice was so complementary that I'll be honest, I didn't find it difficult. It was, at times really boring and you have to sort of get through the day, but I was so content. And then when I've done it since, I have found myself struggling with the inactivity, but all the time there's that sort of promise of the final few days where I'm completely honest, in that I feel so anxiety free and completely serene that, I can only recommend it. That, it's hard work. Initially, there's a novelty factor. You spend a long time sat down in a large hall that is, the lights are dimmed. It's very comfortable. It's kind of warm. It's carpeted. You get given a square foam, a blue square of foam to sit on and as many extra kind of cushions as you want. And my initial experience was days and days of just fidgeting, wrapping stuff around, trying to get my elbows propped up and dipping in and out of kind of quiet mind. But lots and lots of very random thoughts, I became aware of I feel like I'm sort of just washing my head out, so all this sort of debris was rising to the top, really random memories or lots of internal chatter that was sort of really disconnected. And I did kind of look back at that. It's just like, sort of like really scrubbing around in there and stuff was descaling my brain. But the simplest way of looking at the experience is if you are watching your thoughts, i.e., I was just thinking about that time I lost my luggage, or I'm just thinking about a camping holiday, or I really hate my hair, whatever. You then think, I've just been thinking about how I hate my hair, but I'm thinking about thinking. So if I'm the witness to the thought, I get to choose whether I hold on to that thought. So if I say in my head, okay, all right, look, you're thinking about your shit hair again, stop thinking about that. go back to the breath. The breath is, or go back to breathing, breathing through the nose, the temperature of the air hitting the nose and some sort of thing. And then the techniques that they go on to teach you, you're there for 10 days. Initially, you do something extremely simple and rudimentary over and over again. Then you start moving into a, I won't spoil it for you if you haven't done it before, but a kind of a scanning thing. And from that, I would just say that ultimately what that came to show me, or what became manifest, was the sense that one can be constantly looking for oneself in other things. Mm. So I was looking for myself, you know, am I in my head? Well, I'm not in my head because I'm thinking about that right now and I don't think I'm there. Am I in my nose? Am I in my shoulders? Am I in my knees? Am I in this carpet? Am I in the thought of myself? You know, and because there is, no matter what train of thought you go off onto or what tangent you may take, you do remain in control as the witness, the constant observer of all those multifarious things that you just thought about. Mm. There is still one witness, one essential kind of consciousness. And you will notice that as you sit there and do the work, which is going, oh, I've just randomly thought about a pair of trainers. Quick, come back. Stop thinking about that. Start thinking about my breath. Mm. Start thinking about the way I'm sat. Oh, I've just thought about the supermarket, you know, and I just thought about my career. you know, you keep coming back to an essential self, which can only watch. It's not thinking as well, it's only watching. And you start to strengthen that part of you. So that the witness part of you, the observer, simply becomes bolder and more present. And the more present it is, the more you realize that if you wanted to, you have the choice not to constantly react, not to constantly diverge from one thought to the next, and constantly crave an answer and searching. You actually do have a faculty to observe rather than react. And once you really like sort of know that, it's a tool. It's just amazing. And you can leave that retreat and not necessarily start meditating for hours every day. You know, you won't necessarily come out levitating or talking in a different way, but you will have that quality. And then the next time that you feel really pissed off, worried, you know, you can choose to let that worry take you over, or you can stop and witness and wait and sort of trust that things will become clear in time. And there's a sort of acceptance that takes over. And that's what I found it's a great comfort to me, basically.
Yeah. Well, I went on a course 3 years ago, I think it is now, a 6-week course. I was finding everything very, very, very hard. I was very, very sad at the time. And I just needed something. And I watched this wonderful film. I think it's called Walk With Me. If it is, that, then I'll leave this in. If not, then I'll change it because I can't remember the name of it. It's this incredible film about, I think it was about silent retreats. And so I went and did this 6-week course every week for an hour or whatever it was. And I had tried meditation before and really got a lot out of it, but it was one of those things I sort of knew I would get something out of, but I wasn't in the practice of doing it. So I just never did it. And then after this course, I did start gradually trying to do it. And for me, it feels like it's like trying to create space between something happening and my reaction to it. Like in the same way that you're saying.
Yes.
So just creating that space, and it can be a tiny little space, and then the space might grow a little. But it's only after 3 years or so of trying to do it regularly that I feel like if some big emotional thing's happening, I actually have a moment to go, oh, interesting, I'm feeling this way. Maybe I won't react in, you know, in an unthinking way, because like you say, the thoughts and the things come along, that they don't have to define your next actions. But I don't know, there's not normally enough space to sort of consider that unless you practice meditation, it feels like.
No, yeah, you're right. You've entered into a practice that then buys you a little space-time to decide whether you do need to overreact or not. And the thing about reactions are they are mostly unconscious things, and they might have developed when we were babies, you know. I mean, if you really go into the psychoanalytic side of things, you know, there could be neural pathways scratched into our brain from childhood that were related to not having our needs met, mm-hmm. or momentary neglect or trauma, but you know, from really heavyweight stuff to perhaps, you know, circumstantial things. But we may be reacting because of something that happened then that has nothing to do with who we really are now, or the amount of education or experience that we have now, or the amount of love and patience and everything that we have now. We're simply acting just on this kind of sort of sort of chemistry and physics of who we are, not really not the person you want to be or the person that you describe yourself to a friend. And so through that meditation, you know, bringing the idea back that there is actually a witness within you, or, you know, there is you that can just say, well, I'm just accepting because I could get really angry right now or be in floods of tears, but that reaction might stem from something that's completely irrelevant to me now. Mm-hmm. So why would I let that take me over? Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. What you're describing is sort of tapping into that little moment of getting some power, you know, basically regaining your own power, your witness self, just saying, hold on.
Yeah.
You know, there is something much bigger in charge here. And by practicing, I mean, I love that word because practice to me was something you did if you were playing a musical instrument, yeah. or learning tennis or something. through yoga and meditation, you know, practicing yoga, I practice yoga. And I was thought initially, I thought that sounded 20 years ago when I started practicing yoga. I thought that was really a funny word. I don't know, it didn't sort of suit me. But now through the meditation, I really get it. It's like you sit down and you essentially try, you're not necessarily definitely doing it, you know, you're trying, you are practicing, you're getting comfortable, you're sitting down, you're not looking at anything that's creating stimulation, but then you might hear a car alarm, and you could initially get quite annoyed, and then actually it's a brilliant lesson to think, well, I can still meditate through this car alarm.
Yeah,
you know, I can, the sound can just like flow through me, and all these little things, you know, and then the next day you might, you know, you just practice until sometimes you just can't help ignore the fact that you feel very, very light or unperturbed. You are not distracted by anything, and you can emerge from that session, whether it's 15 minutes or an hour and a half or whatever, you can emerge from that feeling really positive. In a way, it's not ecstatic. You're not like bouncing off the walls, because that in itself would be like an extreme.
Yeah.
You know, like really low or really high, I would sort of describe it. But I have felt so calm. Actually, going back to the actual retreat, I must have made some notes. I did write myself up some notes when I came out of it. But to be honest, it's still so clear to me that I don't doubt my own memory of the experience. But after most of the week, there were a few days left, maybe two or three mornings, I woke up in a way that I have never woken up in my life before, which was just to really gently become conscious of, oh, I'm awake now. And it was fucking amazing, because I don't know about you, I always wake up, I mean, particularly now because I have a three-year-old, and I'm just like, I'm so amazed when I get some sleep, and when I do wake up, I'm like, fuck, what time is it? Is he going to... time to myself before he wakes up. But I had these incredible sort of, like water turning into steam. Like, how does that happen? But it just, it was like that. I just woke up and I was just like, I'm really comfortable, and I've just realized, oh, I'm awake. There was no jolt. There was no like, you know, I mean, I'm not like completely at my wit's end when I wake up. Like, I am very comfortable and lucky person, like, my health is good, I'm all right, but you know, I don't have the most amazing sort of seamless wake up. There's always like straight away your brain's going, have I got time to do that, what can I do this, that was one of the most fundamental sensations that, you know, unless you have it, you just don't realize how beautiful it is.
Being properly refreshed,
evaporated awake, it was amazing.
Sorry if you just heard that weird robot noise. I don't know if people can hear it because I have this thing set up that tells me when it's like, because I don't wear a watch, so it tells me when it's like on the hour and a half hour, and it's this robot voice that goes, it's 11:30. So you probably didn't hear that, but I've recreated it for you anyway.
that would help me with my wake up if something just went, it's 5:43. You've got approximately 20 minutes before.
But if they could lovingly whisper it in your ear, because the thing is, I've got this alarm clock that's a horrible noise. It's not a gentle noise. That's not a great start to the day, is it? Something just that's going, not, no. It's like, ugh, horrible, horrible.
Yeah. Change that, I reckon.
I think that's the basic thing. But I was really interested to know whether the first, because you said you did one just before lockdown, before the first lockdown. And then the other one, I was reading, you wrote a piece, didn't you, about it? I think, was it about 10 years ago that you did the first
one?
How different did they feel in terms of stimuli, like you were mentioning? Because smartphones weren't so ubiquitous 10 years ago. And then the amount of information that is available to our brains and that we let into our brains every day has exponentially increased in that time. Do you connect that to any sort of feelings of it being more or less refreshing last time?
Yeah, well, so I've done it. This was a shorter course just before. So just before lockdown was a 4-day event, I think. Mm. And I have a child in this particular occasion. So I didn't feel like I could do 10 days. Mm. It was just too weird. So, and that, bearing that in mind, it wasn't so long. So in some ways it wasn't so hard,
yeah,
if you know what I mean, because well, this will fly by. But I had done it a few years before I had my son. And I did use my phone much more in those days, but I didn't have a son. So I guess, you know, my feeling about it was different. Now I think about it, I didn't necessarily attain that absolute peace, that waking up, like gorgeousness that I was just describing. But I can't really tell if that was sort of the circumstances at the time, yeah, or my phone. But I did find it, I'll be honest, no, I wasn't that distracted because I found it relatively easy in a sort of nice, like comfortable way. I found that space, that like settled, quiet, I'm cozy and this is like stillness. I found that feeling relatively quickly again, even though many years have passed. And I remember thinking of the word like home. It's like, well, I sort of kind of found home, you know, if that's a word we use about places and we feel at home with certain people. It was like that feeling, that complete stable, quiet thing. I remember finding that sensation quite quickly. So I don't think I had necessarily let my phone sort of get into my head in a way that it obstructed my practice there. Plus I have on and off been a practicer of the practicer, is that even a word?
Practitioner.
Here, am I a practitioner? That's it, she's got it, it's practitioner.
Well, lovely to hear some West Country accent, by the way, because I'm in Bristol but I haven't been out much lately, obviously. Oh, so I haven't heard it.
Oh yeah, you have to, yeah, I think I forgot. I realised the other day, I was like, oh, my DAB radio. I was like, why don't I tune into like Somerset Live or something? Yeah. Get a bit of, yeah. Oh, I love a bit of Somerset. It's just, yeah, it's just so comforting.
Yeah. And
I couldn't honestly say, oh yeah, I feel like lifestyle now is so distracting and it's detrimental, etc. Even though I'm kind of one of those people that would, you know, presume that, and yeah, would actually, I mean, I'm really terrified as to how is my little boy going to grow up with all of this junk, you know. So if I had felt that it really interfered with me, I'd be the first to say.
Yes.
but actually no, and maybe that's because I had that foundation stone sort of somewhere within me because of the first time I'd done it.
Yeah.
And the first time was so needed in my life, and so you know, I sort of landed in that place and in that practice just at the right time that it's really stayed with me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I have been a practitioner every day of my life since. I go through weeks where for one reason or another I don't do it, and sometimes it's a sort of stubborn I'm like really in the physical world and I'm just like, oh, I haven't got time for that, like how am I gonna get this shit done if I'm just fucking sat around doing fuck all.
Yeah.
And so I sort of, you know, I let myself, I almost let my emotional, mental and physical health health slide sometimes, and I know I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I know I'm doing it. I'm just, I'm overtired. I can't think straight. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I want to drink wine and it's no good. But that in itself doesn't last. Mm. Then there's a little ray of sunshine kind of like beams into my brain. Yeah. And I think I need to find that home space. So I do, you know, I do find the quiet corner of the room and I just get into it. And then I get on a roll and it's with me for many weeks. And I appreciate what I'm doing and I appreciate that kind of quality of like observing and all of that wonderfulness, you know, and then there'll be a little blip and I can't do it for a bit. That's, I think that in itself is cool. It's like you've got to accept that. If I kept punishing myself, I'd just be miserable. And now I look forward to it. It's like, oh, yeah, tonight, you know.
Mm. I'm smiling and nodding a lot because I think it's so interesting how we're all our own worst enemy in so many ways, in the same ways as well. Because say yesterday morning I was feeling really sludgy and crap, and I knew that if I did yoga and I did even 10 minutes of meditation, because I'm not doing it for hours, it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I knew I'd feel better, and I did.
Yeah.
But it's still hard to do it. It's still hard to make yourself do something that you know is going to make you feel better. And it's only 15 minutes out of the entire day. It's not much.
I know. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I mean, I've sort of read more. I mean, there's so many. Actually, I don't know if there's so many. There's so many books out there, all they sort of new age, mindful, meditative, you know, ilk. Mm-hmm. And I've gone through periods of time where I just devour them all. Like, I love all that. But I've realised over time that some of it is quite bland. And the real classics are like Eckhart Tolle, or he might be Tolle. I don't really know how to pronounce it. Eckhart Tolle, with The Power of Now, and then his other sort of really little books, such as this, that's right by my computer, Stillness Speaks. They're little excerpts. Mm. Yeah. You know, he's so articulate, and it reads to me, he writes, because he is an academic, but it reads like an academic text that's also extremely easy to digest. That's not pretentious. And is really clear, and there's just nothing in it where it doesn't make sense, you know. And when you read these sorts of texts to accompany your motivated sort of thinking, like you really want to do it right now, don't you? But you're kind of like not quite there. But if you surround yourself with a few key writers, Eckhart Tolle is one, and there's another guy that's not writing about meditation. He's writing about the way the body stores trauma. Yeah, there's another guy's book that I really appreciated that's not really linked to this conversation about meditation, but it's linked to the way that we store pain or you know, our lack of energy, or we hold ourselves back sometimes unconsciously. And he talks about the brain and trauma and stuff. His name is Bessel van der Kolk. Okay. And that's a great book, so I recommend. I've just found when I haven't committed fully to a week or a month of doing it how I should, then I start picking up some texts again that I know are really incisive, and it just gets me back on the track, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason I brought that up was probably both of those authors and more will point out, you know, that the mind, which is not necessarily, you know, that isn't me. I'm not my mind. I know that because I've witnessed my mind going off randomly thinking about all kinds of crap. So I know I'm not my mind, but my mind, which is so easy to sort of like slip forward into, my mind just seeks gratification. So it will go from thinking about wanting over, you know, ordering a new coat on the internet, looking at that, getting some food, getting a cup of coffee, you know, and it will go all over the place, mostly to sort of, out of fear that it doesn't exist, you know, it just wants to exist, so it just wants more.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so difficult to sit down and do something you know is good for you, because your mind is really strong and it's really trying to get lots of tiny little, you know, bumps of gratification. And sitting down and being ignored is just like, that's the worst thing your mind can imagine. So it's just like, no, don't do that. You know you're hungry, you know you want a bath, you know that you want to finish that Netflix series, and you know that you'd quite like to open your laptop now and just have a look, see whether you're going to buy some new shoes and stuff. Yeah, like, you know, because and you're essentially denying its existence when you meditate. So it will do anything it wants to stop you doing it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, of course, there's all the marketing in the world to encourage that behaviour, you know, online especially, because that's human psychology that people are, and people are learning about that so they can use it, so they can sell us their products in the various ways. So, So if the mind is the thing that's like the naughty kid that wants the sweets, what's the rest of it? What's the other stuff that's able to go, no, I want to nourish my mind and my body, and I want to be creative perhaps, or do other things?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not an authority, but when I read things and it's described as consciousness, I think, I'd have that. I'd say that's consciousness, it's intelligence, it's present. You know, there's lots of words people will use, but sort of presence of mind rather than the mind. You know,
that makes sense.
Of mind. I have the presence of mind, or I feel present. I'm concentrating in a way that's not really hard and forced. I'm just concentrating. I'm taking everything in. I'm not doing something at the same time, i.e. reacting. I'm not doing that. So, I think you could say that the rest of you is like pure intelligence. And I don't mean that like scholastic intellectual. I mean just intelligence, like nature is intelligent and will open up buds in the spring when there's longer spells of sunshine. You know, that's the intelligence of the plant working in harmony with the elements, you know. And I think we have the potential to enact our intelligence and be empathetic and loving and healthy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, loads of times we won't be that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you feel that you're able to be more intentional with your creative work, having gone through these experiences with meditation?
Yes. What would I say about that? Creatively, I won't stand for a sense of lyrical unease to, you know, but I won't ignore that. So I do sort of observe how I feel whilst I'm making stuff up, or I'll make it all up and not worry about it and then come back and just like observe, like honestly how it actually feels. How's it feel in my chest, my stomach? What am I thinking? You know, I just sort of observe the whole terrain, as it were. And I think in the past, when I was younger, I may have, you know, I will admit to it sometimes, oh, I don't know, I can't really think of how to end that, so I'm just going to put that in there. That's all right. You know, and I've regretted it later. Fortunately, not enough people really heard it, so it doesn't matter. But, you know, I'm less inclined to hurrying up and finishing for the sake of the exercise and for the goal of like this record to be finished. I take great delight in finding just the right word at the right time. And there's a song from my last album that came out in August lockdown, has a song called Atoms at Me. And honestly, we'd finished absolutely everything else and we'd booked the mixer. So it was all kind of about to be delivered as little parcels of email, WAVs. And I still hadn't got a proper chorus. It was, how's your mother? Just complete. Because I knew that the phrasing, I loved the phrasing. I loved how it fell out and the rhythm against the rhythm of the track and the guitar line. And I had it, it was one of the first things I had, but then I could never put words in the spaces. Yeah. You know, I was struggling for consonants and vowels to just fall into place. And I did get something, and I do think, you know, I stand by it and I'm glad that I did in the end. But had I rushed that, I don't think I'd have been really observing properly. And sort of, I'd have been impatient, which would have been my mind wanting to finish that so that I could send it off and have my album out earlier. But I trusted not to do that because I just sort of had a sense that I hadn't found any good words yet.
Yeah.
So that's one example. I mean, there must be other things I can't necessarily think. But yeah, maybe I'm a bit more rigorous, I think might be the word, maybe.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
Rigorous in, waiting and accepting and and then melody wise I like to be just super free with it, you know. Nobody's really listening to me. I can just do whatever I want to begin with, and it can be quite a lot of the time I come up with little little bits that I'll say to my partner, oh, you won't like this, and I know I won't like it tomorrow, but you've got to hear it. It's just like such a pop song, check this out. And we're both laughing at the ridiculous kind of saccharine, heard it before, you know, the intervals of the notes are just so predictable, and it's essentially like rubbish, but it's just brilliant in it for a moment. So we've got we've got stacks of that stuff where I'm just like, I could be in Girls Aloud with this shit, listen. And and it'll be brilliant for 45 minutes, and then and then we're just like, and delete. And because of I don't know how that's directly linked to my meditation practice, how can I link that quickly, only that I am prepared to do whatever in the moment, and sort of you know, a bit like I was saying at the beginning, sort of descale the brain a bit. I'm prepared to like let out a load of sort of crap and even laugh at it and even play it back with some extra delay and reverb on it for a bit, rather than that sort of, you know, when you're sort of trying to edit something before it's even left your head.
That's not,
you know, I mustn't say that, I mustn't type that, I mustn't put that, you know, we mustn't let it out into the manifest world in case, you know, I don't know, fairies see you do it and criticize you. I have it like that, you know what I mean? But now it's just like, do anything and don't be so self-critical, and therefore enjoy the play of life and creativity, and later you can laugh at it and put it to one side.
We can't edit something if it doesn't exist in the first place, can you? Like, you can't sculpt something if there's no material to sculpt it from. That's not a block of stuff. That took me a long time to learn, though. I honestly, I think I just assumed that people who were good lyricists, it just fell out, you know, in perfect sentences.
Well, I think for some people it really does. I mean, I think if you're Nick Cave or Morrissey, or I don't know, Joan Baez, I mean, I just think you're probably, I don't know, maybe there's just poetry constantly running through your brain.
Do you really think that, though? Because I'm sure everyone has to work at it. That's how I get through life, is knowing that most people have to work at their craft. Yeah, it's a craft,
actually,
isn't it?
Yeah. This is a silly little mention, but now that we're in that conversation, I actually have a sheet of A4 lined paper from once I was in the studio with Nick Cave. I was doing some backing vocals.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's amazing.
And he won't remember. And I was just really timid all day because I sort of didn't acknowledge that I was a huge fan. And I was burning hot the whole day. I just felt so overwhelmed in his presence. But he had a sheet of paper with lyrics on, and then he passed them to me because he was in on the other side of the window and I was singing them. And then, fuck that, scratch that. And we were sort of swapping words out. And so I kept it. I did tell him I was keeping it, and did he mind? And I wouldn't sell it on eBay. I just would really like it. But yeah, that's got loads of scratchings out, a few things that like rhyme really terribly, and then he'd replace them.
Yeah.
And so I guess even the great Prince of Darkness does it himself. Yeah. So okay, we'll have that one then.
I rehearsed next door to Nick Cave once in a band I was playing in years ago, and I just remember like leaning up against the wall to try and hear just a little bit of them rehearsing, and then we would peek out the door and we could see some of the bad seeds wandering around. I was just like, this is the coolest day of my life. It was so exciting. Wow. But yeah, I wouldn't have been able to say hello or anything. There's no way. Just would have like blushed and ran off. So well done for even managing to sing. That must have been quite terrifying.
Yeah, I didn't really realise I was a blushing person, but I sort of just was on full blush to 11 all day. I was just like, it's so hot all day. I can't believe this. I can't believe you really are there.
He probably moves through life thinking that people blush a lot because he's there and he's like making people do it.
Lots of iconic people. Maybe. Yeah, they just think that the world, that white people are often quite rosy.
Yeah. What a funny life he leads with all these blushing people around him all the time. I don't know, there are certain people for me I just wouldn't be able to speak, so I totally understand that.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like I'm relatively okay, you know, I'm not a really shy person, but whenever I meet someone who's incredibly impressive and has, you know, like that sort of soundtracked part of your life, I just get so tongue-tied.
Yeah.
And it's sort of really silly, isn't it? Stupid.
Well, especially, and you've done loads of cool shit. So like, you know, you've sung with Mark Lanegan, you've done stuff with Uncle, you've released seven albums, or is there an album with Roman Remains as well? How many albums have you done now?
How many albums? So Duke Spirit Records, one, 5 albums, Duke Spirit albums, 2 on my own, and 1 Roman Moraine. That's 8.
Yeah,
that's good, great. Isn't it? Oh, well done, mate. Well done. You. You've done all right. Prolific. Yeah, you've done all right.
Do you feel like that was intentional? It's a lot of words you've written. Have you got any more in there? Are you running low?
Yes, I do run low. I do. And I have recently signed up for some sort of like online learning. In fact, I was just filling in the form yesterday with Birkbeck College. You know, they do kind of like adult learning. Because very, very much, partly through some personal things in my life, I'm just like, yeah, I want to know more about that. But but also I hit a wall and just think, I just have no expertise in anything at all. And I'd like to learn something again fully and have some confidence in what I'm saying and get some different vocabulary. And I know that I could do that through reading lots, but I'd sort of like somebody in authority there as well to say, have you thought of this? No, I had not thought of that. Oh, thanks.
Yeah, that is really helpful.
Yeah, I feel it's just maybe it's just a certain time in my life. I'm sort of ready to, you know, devour some knowledge again now. Because yes, I do find I've run out of words and I feel I get a bit down on myself, and that's probably the right time to go and find a quiet room to meditate, isn't it?
I'd say so.
Accept the situation.
But
it's not that it's intentional to make that many records. I can't see, you know, I can't imagine wanting to stop. And sometimes it's hard because you've got to try and fund a normal life and having lots of time in the studio and stuff, so that's always a bit of a juggle, but it's good, things are okay. And at times you wonder whether, you know, why is this important? Because is it because it's your ego wanting other people to say, oh, well done? But I think I'm through the other side of that now, where I just think, no, I just love finding out about myself through words, and you know, I don't care anymore. I love melody, and I'll just chase that probably. Well, I will chase that forever, really.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting what you were saying about wanting to learn stuff, because so much of making music can be a blag, and which is good because it means that you don't have to have particular, you know, exams or particular training to do it. Anyone could be making their own music and expressing themselves that way. That's one of the things I love about it so much. But I've definitely got to the point where I just want to do things at a better quality always. So I've been doing a lot of online learning, like graphic design stuff and bits and bobs like that. It's not like this pandemic came along and gave me loads of extra time in my life or anything to do all these, you know, bake sourdough and do an online course or anything like that. I wonder if it's, which apparently some people are managing to do, which is cool and all. But I don't know if it's just, you know, having, I don't know if it's the repetition of things. I am going somewhere with this question, by the way. But like the repetition, once you've done a few records, so I've done 5 now myself, my 5th one's about to come out. I think once you've done stuff a lot, and like I've toured a lot, and I've written a decent amount of songs, then of course I'm going to want to do it in a better way or a more fulfilling way or something. And of course also as a slightly older person, it's going to be not necessarily the absolute only thing I want to do. It's not the absolute center of my life, because hopefully friendships and relationships and other people and other things will also add to the richness of a life. And so, you know, rather than, you know, in my early 20s, all I cared about, it was all I cared about. Like nothing else mattered. I think it's good when other things matter, because it means there's more in your life to matter.
Yeah, and I think now I look back, you know, especially the conversation we've had today about the mind and, you know, the ego, there was so much about wanting to sort of succeed in music that was actually a deep-seated animal drive to, you know, have an identity and have individuality. And it's all, you know, you think that that's what you wanted, and I still want to do the things related to that, but I no longer have a sort of animalistic, ego driven desperation to be recognized and put on a pedestal, because I realize now a lot of that may have been hormonally driven, you know, a lot of it is fake. And it lasts for a while, so that you are on a pedestal and you are stronger and more vigorous or whatever. You know, I can look back and see that there's that kind of like desperation to win or whatever. And then you kind of grow out of it a little bit, unless you're Donald Trump or something, and you're stuck in that. He's like a hamster in a wheel for the rest of his life. Like, imagine. Fuck. And if he reincarnates, he'll probably reincarnate as a fucking snail or something, you know. So I feel grateful that I can see a little evolutionary step. And I also feel grateful that I still feel so in love with singing and words that I am sort of bound to this path.
Yeah.
Because I think it's poetry in motion, you know, and I'm so glad to taste that and have that. But I also realize that the sort of ego driven side of it, I can drop that. It isn't so important. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to say that I won't stand on a stage, you know, because it's just so ironic, isn't it? I say all that and I'm like, yeah, I might play a gig and be like, oh, look at me. But in but in that, there is a transformation of, you know, the sort of younger, desperate self into feeling more of a channel, you know. I feel like this is good work. And I'm channeling it through, and we're all together, and there is a harmony in the room or the space, and I feel like that's justified. You know?
Well, there's a massive giving of yourself with that as well, to the people in that room and to the people who are listening to your music. I've sort of been like having a lot of thinking time over the past few years through the meditation and obviously through the pandemic and things, and just thinking about how it used to feel to me like I was asking of other people, love me, tell me I'm important, all the things we're talking about here, like not necessarily put me on a pedestal as such, but certainly, you know, justify my existence, you know, justify the fact that I'm not wasting my time doing this thing. Whereas in the last couple of years, it's definitely switched around to more like, I'm giving you this thing.
Yeah.
And there's like this sort of stepping aside of the ego part. Whereas I would have thought 2 years ago saying that, that's so egotistical to think I'm giving people something, you know. Who the fuck does she think she is? So generous, giving a song. Do you know what I mean? But actually, that is what I'd prefer to feel like I'm doing. Because it's not, I'm not saying give me something back. I'm saying I give you this.
And every time you listen to music as a fan of music, you know, you do realise you're receiving something that gives you such pleasure and such company.
Exactly.
That you don't just, we don't constantly listen to music thinking, this person singing is such an egomaniac, do we? So, you know, but like you say, it's taken a while to flip, like the way, the perspective that we see through which we see things. Yeah,
totally. A lot of artists have been postponing their album releases because of COVID, which is, you know, completely legitimate. But you actually put your second solo album out last August, didn't you?
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that decision and how that's worked out.
Well, I couldn't honestly see any reason not to do it, in that I'm not a big enough artist that I'd set up huge kind of national European tours that would then be postponed, and you know the sort of, I don't know, the paper trail of all of that would have been a headache. So given that the whole process of putting things out is mostly digital and you're hoping for a bit of radio play and all of those things can happen whether you're going outside or not, I just thought, well, why not, really? It was very disappointing not to animate that album with a real show. That will have to come later, and maybe because I'm fortunate enough to have home studio and there were songs left over that I already knew that I'd started working on, I think within a few days of the reality hitting of what was going on this spring, summer, I think we just made a decision of like, well, I'm not going to change plans, put it out, keep going, come out with the next one as well. And then maybe when you tour, you'll be touring sort of two sets of albums worth of material. I couldn't really justify stopping it. I mean, it was good. We knew that we had playlisted song at Six Music, and more people were inside turning the radio on. So I mean, it was probably better, really. Why pull it? It's just so upsetting when there's a couple of moments on an album that you feel really sort of passionate about, and your sort of deepest wish would be like, oh, it'd be great to play this on a sort of festival stage, and then you realize there are no festivals, there's nothing happening, you know. That's disappointing, but you know, hey, there's a yeah. lot worse disappointment out there. So just get on, yeah. just get on and put it out there.
Yeah, I feel the same. I feel exactly the same. And I think if it's in your power to put things out still, then people really, really appreciate new things coming into the world. That's the feedback I was getting last year. I started putting the Pen Friend singles out after ending my previous solo project. And I just thought, oh, you know, am I trying to make this all about me? Is it going to look like I'm going, look at me, I'm more important than the global pandemic? And of course, people don't think of it that way at all. And that's just all in my head, sort of imposter syndrome nonsense. But yeah, I've definitely been feeling that and being told that people are just excited about anything new from artists they like. So I just thought it was really great that you did that anyway.
No, oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, I was talking to a fellow musician about the same thing the other day. Mm. Johnny Hostile was talking about his work with Jenny Beth, and he was like, oh, I think it's really brave when people just put their music out in 2020, and we should put on there should be like a festival of people that put out records in 2020. Like, we yes. did it. We were brave. We risked yeah. so much, you know, we yeah. risked being ignored, but we did it anyway. And so I should get back to him on that, actually. I think yeah. he should organise that, right?
I think so. Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm a very small independent artist. So whenever I put something out, there's always that sort of like excitement of, and this, you know, one song could do something and life could change in some way. And most of the time in my career, it's been very incremental and that hasn't happened because that's sort of like a fairy tale, really. That's not a thing that's based in reality. Like you say, you hope for radio, you hope for press, you hope for this and that. If it comes, great. If it doesn't, then you still have to make the next record. But I think now it's kind of a bit more accelerated because I'm thinking, mine's coming out in May, and I'm pretty certain there won't be gigs that I will be doing this year anyway, if others may. So what do I do next? I suppose I just make another one. Like you're saying, you just sort of make the next one then. And then hopefully next year, there'll be a time to bring all that together for like a mega set of
yeah,
celebrating
this. That's the yeah. thing is, it's sort of like you come to write your set list in, let's say early. I will admit to having a gig scheduled in London in June, that there's been no decision making on whether to pull it or not pull it, no discussion yeah. because it just doesn't feel even worth having a discussion at the moment because things are so no. in flux. But I maybe have a hunch that that won't happen, and we should, you know, because really, like, should I be encouraging loads of people that haven't been vaccinated to squash into a room, even, you know, if the government were to allow that activity?
Yeah,
I don't know if I can sort of do that. So let's say you're writing a set list in October 2021. It's just going to be good if you've got that album that you put out in lockdown.
Yeah.
Your new one, and you just got loads of songs to choose from. You can make a really dynamic set.
Yeah.
And you know, have one album out, and then your merch stand will look fantastic with the other one on there as well. Just like bountiful.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about how just making obviously, you've made lots of albums already, and just the idea of making them into the future rather than sort of fetishizing one and putting all your eggs in that thing. It's like betting on one horse or something. That's not really what music making is about when it's a career, is it?
No, no. And I think you do that with the first thing you ever do. You do that because you're so excited to have created a body of work.
Yeah.
And if you're very lucky, you will have success and probably never look back. But if you have some success but not all the success on that, you know, you'll quickly realize that the sense of intensified ambition and hopefulness wrapped up in one thing is you know, it's kind of pointless. And it's also you know, it's just like we talked before about the more psychological, spiritual sides of life, you know, it's a little bit of your ego just desperately trying to be identified as the best, you know. It's just like, don't worry about being the best, be good. Just be good.
Yeah, be you.
Yeah.
I just finished rereading On Writing by Stephen King, and it's I don't know if you've read that, but it's kind of like a book about how to write, but it's also a bit of an autobiography. It's really interesting. And he talked about how when he got a big house after earning lots of money, and he got his giant desk, and he put it in the middle of this room, He talks about his alcoholism and drug problems, like for the next few years, sitting there, like not really doing his best work and not feeling happy. And he said then he got rid of the giant desk and he moved it under the eaves in the attic, and he put chairs and tables and stuff and just made it into more of like a lounge kind of area. So his kids could come and hang out with him in that room. And then he would write underneath the attic roof. And then he said, I've written this down so I could sound like I remembered it. Hold on. Don't tell anyone. And he said he did that because writing is there to support life, not the other way around.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that is brilliant.
Yeah,
that's
that
so
is
good.
Great. That is great. I've just written down Stephen King, why I write to.
Yeah, Virgil. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's so interesting. Such a good book. And I really like that because over the years, we talked about the kind of repetition of making albums and touring and how, like you say, it becomes less about this egotist. It's never not about ego, is it? But it becomes less about like, I am defined by this one thing in life and I have to be the best at it. And then it becomes like, well, like the first album's the hardest because you've never done one before. And then once you've done, what, eight now? So like, you just make albums. That's just what you do. I think that's really interesting to almost give space to other things. I was just wondering if that was something you had to consciously do at any point, because your schedule must have been pretty brutal with the Duke Spirit.
Oh yeah, well, give space to other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was this time between like 2007, 8, 9 and 10, great, like a really great chunk of time, 4 years or whatever, where I could never say to a friend, like a friend might say, we're going to do this camping holiday, or a bunch of us are going to hire this villa, or we're going to go on holiday, or we're going to go on whatever. I could never ever commit to anything with any friends. I could only do stuff with the band, because we never, you know, although there'd be a bit of planning, and you'd know that you next 6 weeks or something, and then good things would happen all the time. Do you want to support these guys? Oh yeah, that'd be great. Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Of course I would never say no. Not only would I not say no, probably because I wanted to do such and such, but because you couldn't let the other guys down. And occasionally I remember feeling just like a little bit upset that I just never did anything with my girlfriends. Never could. They'd plan things. I was like, oh, I can't really, yeah, I don't know. And then I'd probably be away. And so you just had to make friends in the areas that you went. And I did spend a lot of time in LA, and that was just really, it was brilliant. You know, it was great.
Yeah.
And so you become really good friends with like your tour managers and the people that you're renting the accommodation off, and some of the people at the label, and, you know, some really, really good times then. But I remember thinking, this is weird. I never do anything planned anymore with anyone who's like a long-term friend or relative. I never do this. And that was a bit weird. And it was quite difficult that Dan was in the first, first incarnation of the band. And he had a kid, you know, and he sort of had to choose whether he would carry on doing what we do or whether he should stop, and because we just never knew where we were going to be. And he knew that he might have to bail out suddenly, and he also wanted to be a good dad. So he left, you know, and kind of didn't really want to, but he left because of the constant moving around. And now I've forgotten what your question was at the beginning.
Oh, I don't know. Oh yeah, about letting letting other things in.
Yeah. And so I remember thinking, I really like what I've got, but I've got to let like other stuff in, like doing friends stuff and hanging out, and just one point where something was cancelled and we had a bit of time, and I just literally, from the cancellation to like 48 hours later, I jumped on a plane and went and met some girlfriends in India.
Oh, nice.
And I couldn't let other things in, is what I'm saying. I couldn't let other things in. And so you have to find that friendship, you know, on the move or around you. And I did. And I was really lucky because there's some great people out there on the planet who've become friends because of what we did with our band. So it's really good. But yeah, you had to just act super quick. If you're like going to do something with the family or friends, it's like, do it now before. That happens less so now because, you know, we haven't put out a record for a few years. And I've just spent the last 3 years going, ooh, do you have a child? This is really weird. But coming to terms with the fact that, oh, I still can make music, and I probably will, you know, I will play again. And it's all okay. You can do it all. You know, you can.
You can, but you can't do it all at once. That's what I've been trying to teach myself recently. And I don't have a kid or anything, but yeah, I was always the person who was away. I was always the person who wasn't available for whatever, someone's, you know, party, wedding, whatever. Just could never do it. And people were so accommodating and so understanding and supportive because they understood what I was trying to do. But I think, I wonder sometimes, should I regret that? But if I don't regret it, then I don't. So yeah, I'm fine.
It's fine.
I'm not going to make myself regret something I don't regret. It's fine. But I think, this sort of enforced grounding of everyone is quite an interesting time to sort of look back and go, well, would I do things differently in future if I had the choice? So I've been thinking about that a bit.
Yeah, we got a dog at a point where we thought we probably had a bit of space and a bit of ground. We were a bit more grounded, but we were a bit, if we get a dog there, that's kind of like, you know, admitting you can't just, but I'm so in love with my animal. She's just the best. And honestly, the other day I walked downstairs and I went, hello. And she went, hello. She literally yawned hello at me. She met in the morning, she kind of goes, and she literally said hello to me, and I was just like, you're just one of the best things in my life. I love
it. Wonderful, aren't they? My dog's in here again.
Yeah. Oh, hiya. What's your dog called?
That one's called Albie. You can't really see. Albie. And then Benji's on the floor looking really bored. He's so sick of me talking to people.
Sorry, mate. I know.
He's not impressed by anyone. Don't take it personally.
You wouldn't be bored if you saw my my dog. If she saw you trying to eat you, that's a bit of a problem.
What kind of dog do you have?
She's a German Shepherd. A white German Shepherd, yeah. She's mostly what I Instagram, really.
I'm going to have a look. Does she look like a wolf then?
She does, yeah. And awesome. A dire wolf as well, I guess.
Yeah.
I was just out with her this morning. It's good. Recycling men leaning out the window like, that's a proper real life dire wolf you've got there. And I'm like, I know.
Yay. Proper. Yeah, don't mess.
Proper lady bastard.
My sister got a Rottweiler recently, a rescued Rottweiler called Deezer. He's amazing. I haven't met him yet, obviously, because we haven't seen each other for ages. But no one messes with them now. Not that they necessarily did before, but her and her kids are just like, we'll be walking the dog around the estate. And people just cross. Obviously, they cross the road because everyone's crossing the road. But I think they're crossing the road with slightly more acceleration now. Although, of course, he's lovely, would never hurt anyone. But it's, certain dogs will make people stay away, I think.
Yeah, ours is a rescue. So it's just the best thing that we did.
Dogs are great. What is success to you, and have you ever experienced it?
I have felt what I think is a sensation like success when people have texted me, you know, upon hearing something I've done on the radio, say, or somewhere. And that the more far flung they are, or like the longer it is since I've seen that person, the more amazing it feels. So sort of something out of the blue, someone says, I just heard your track on so-and-so. And I just feel really elated because there's a, it just means that we're connected. Like we reestablish some funny bond, like might be an old school friend or someone I know who's miles away on the other side of the planet. And I don't just mean like the obvious, like social media, but someone actually texts you or emails you saying, I just heard this, really like it, or whatever, you know, and they're so far away from you or haven't seen you in 10 years. It's just such a nourishing feeling of like, that inspired you to like say hi to me again. And I just love that sensation. So, yeah, that's what it's felt like to me.
That's lovely. Like a message in a bottle going out into the world.
Yeah, just really... I don't know. It's the connectivity that I just love.
That's lovely. Final question. What's your next creative adventure?
Well, I actually have one. If you'd have asked me that a couple of months ago, I was like, oh God, I have to make something up, sound interesting. I really want, related to the, to an album title that I think I might use, but I'm not sure, so I won't say it, but I'm thinking I might design some kind of, I might do some designs. They might be a kind of like a tarot deck. So things that I feel like symbolically would speak to one's unconscious intelligence, you know, sort of images. I might just do something visual art-wise and make a kind of pack of cards. So if anyone else out there does that, I said it first, okay?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I was just ordering some artist materials. So I'm just going to work. I'm going to do some visual stuff, and it might turn into like a pack of cards, which would then relate to an album, which would then be something I might use. Mm. I might then manufacture them. So I don't
know. Cool.
Yeah, I haven't quite. Love that. I haven't processed the thought, but it's just been. Yeah, it's just been something I thought I might do.
Well, now you've said it, you have to do it because someone else might race you to it otherwise, who's listening and is being sneaky.
Yeah, true.
So I'll just say to listeners, please don't hurry her up too much because, you know, it's your idea in the first place. But also, please make it because that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and creatively, what else was on my mind? Yeah, I'm gonna grow some vegetables. Fucking
nice.
Grow some vegetables. In lockdown, it was just so difficult because the garden centre, this is good, isn't it? It's really cool, rock and roll, sexy. The garden centre was closed initially and then gradually they opened. But by that point, they were all sold out of everything and I wasn't quite sure how I could do it in a sort of courtyard. And now I've realised I could. And I've actually got seeds and we're putting them in tiny germination pots. And I'm trying to teach my son what it is to water things and see shoots. Which I think is sort of really earthy and great. And he just goes, yeah, anyway, about that Lego, can I need to water? And I'm going, don't you want to help me water them? No. But yeah, that might be, if I create a vegetable, I'm going to be so stoked. If I create an actual courgette, I'm going to be like, yeah, it's nice. One of the most creative moments of my career.
Yeah, we grew our first veg last year.
Jealous.
Mixed success. It was pretty good. We were going to go to garden centres and then we couldn't. And then we bought some plug plants off eBay, which just doesn't seem like the best way to buy plants, really. They were for flowers and they were a bit of a hassle, but some of them grew. And then we managed to get some vegetable stuff growing. But we didn't do it from seeds because we always leave it too late. So thank you for reminding me that now is the time to do the seeds.
Oh, yeah.
I remember in June or something.
I've been writing like post-it notes to myself, just like, if you want... So we're too early for courgette at the moment. Okay. But if you want peas or leeks or broccoli, now's the time.
Yeah.
So,
okay, you know. Good to know. We grew corn, which was from a plant. They were huge.
Really?
And they grew actual sweet corn on them.
And indoors or? Perhaps?
No, in my back garden. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a tiny back garden in a tiny raised bed.
What's a plug plant then?
I think you just sort of, I wonder if it's called a plug plant because you just plug it in the soil. You get it and you plug it in. I don't know. I don't know why it's called that. But they're really small.
Uh-huh.
I'm pointing, no one can hear me show you the size. They're really little things. And then you just stick them in and then hopefully they grow. We did have good flowers, actually. More of this.
Yeah, it's quite good that, isn't it? I mean, there's what I liked about lockdown was forcing you to do things like that and think, okay, well, the most interesting thing that might happen is sort of like very gradual, you know, watching nature at play and gradual progression of the year and to not ignore it and go out and do the stuff that we do in society, but actually to sort of just like really reduce activity to the point of like real care and attention to the season change and everything. I thought it's pretty brilliant, but it's not so brilliant if you can't get outside or you don't have a garden and you know, obviously it's not perfect.
Yeah, we just have to do what we can within our worlds,
right? Yeah.
And then create more musical worlds as well.
Exactly.
And okay, so which three pieces of your work would you recommend new listeners get involved with?
Right. Well, my last album, Who the Power, was out in August 2020. And there's a couple of tracks on there that I just feel just felt quite important to me at the time in terms of our global outlook on things and what we're going to inherit, you know, for the next few decades, you know, like what's in the post with the way that our global politics has gone. So I would say listening to a track called The Individual and Watching the Wolf. Those two tracks just feel really important to me. There's a single that was never on a Duke Spirit album called Surrender, and it's a great groove. And I always look back and think, oh, not many people heard that, but I'm really proud of it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been such a pleasure to meet you and to talk about all this stuff. Thank you very, very, very much.
Oh, thank you, Laura, for really great questions. You've made me have to put my brain in gear, which I don't think I do very often anymore. And it's lovely to speak to you. I'm looking forward to listening to your music, and speak again. And have a really good lockdown.
Have a nice life. Wasn't that great? It really was very exciting to meet Leela and to really get into the meditation stuff especially. Regular listeners will know it comes up now and then, but this is the first time my enthusiasm has been matched and actually even eclipsed, and I left this conversation thoroughly energised to keep on with my practice. If you're interested in seeing what meditation can do for you, I highly recommend heading to YouTube and searching for the Yoga with Adrienne channel, which has some excellent short meditations suitable for beginners. I also swear by the Mindful Movement, also on YouTube, which have tons of short, medium and long guided meditations for you to try. Back to Leela though, who has lots of excellent music that you need in your collection. As always, I've made a deluxe show notes page on my website at penfriend.rocks/Leela, where you can also pick up 2 free Penfriend songs, pre-order my album, and find the full library of past episodes. If you're enjoying Attention Engineer, please do me the kindest favour and share it with a friend. Plus, I'd obviously love you to subscribe so that you can hear next week's conversation as well. This is a completely independent podcast which relies on word of mouth to keep reaching people, so any help with that is greatly appreciated. I'll be back with you next Wednesday with yet another deep conversation about creativity, grit and determination, so I hope to catch you then. Take care. Keep a kiss for me, 'cause we all fall.